Okay, this is part two of my conversation with Brian Taylor, who's in Toronto and I'm in Maui, and we're analyzing the somnambulistic reality of the Facebook page form for McLuhan Scholars. Martin Spear says, "Hi, Blake. I absolutely do not know what you mean with, quote, very poor media ecology, unquote. There are thousands of people working on this topic on this planet right now. Not that they are all assembled anywhere, but I don't see something very poor." And then I don't get the rest in that one. I'd have to go to the another layout of the full statement. But just dealing with that.
I have it. Should I continue?
Oh, yeah, you got it there. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So he says,
if you ask me, is that what he's trying to say?
Pardon?
Where it cuts off, if you me, maybe he's saying, if you ask me, or if you
oh,
me.
No, I have it. Okay. It goes on. So he says, but I don't see something very poor. If you mean the Media Ecology Association, I disagree too. The MEA is a great platform to discuss media ecology in all forms. And I also disagree that we don't need intellectual elites anymore. The contrary seems the case, watching and reading current news. I, in contrary, notice that there is a desperate desire of absolutely non-educated people to be part of the elite everywhere, demonstrating their envy in social media and on the streets, and voting for parties who want to exterminate the existing elites for exactly this reason. To come to power themselves and try to build up very primitive rules compared to those existing. The easy answers, far away from facts and truths or scientific standards or insights.
That is so fourth school of media ecology, diasporic, POB, in his statement. It's ridiculous. So instead of being on the defensive, come up with a pattern of why people think they're equal to the elite. What is it in Web 2.0 that makes people feel they're equal and have access to the non-facts as much as anybody else? It's almost like the people know that everybody's winging it because you can't determine what's true anymore. And this is said before the phrase fake news and alternate facts came up the last month or so. But he is not looking. If I was Martin, and I want to say, this seems to be the syndrome that people want to take over the elites. I'd begin to look at the environment in McLuhan terms. I wouldn't defend
right.
myself. I wouldn't say I'm worried about people doing that. I'd say, well, what is going on here?
And it's not good enough to just say the new media, therefore that effect. I mean, McLuhan also would point to something, some aspect of the medium that was analogical with something about the trend or phenomenon. It's not good enough to just call it out.
Right. You could even say that the main characteristic of electric media is the audience gets in the act, the participational impulse that electric involvement, electric media demands. So
right.
Now you have people, they were all inside the tactile swamp, I won't even call it audio tactile or oral culture, the tactile swamp of the 60s and 70s under analog media, everybody was involved in different ways and also equally dropping out from it. But when you actually were given in what I call the Android meme phase, which is technology extending itself and not extending our senses or the planet anymore, is extending itself, it actually allows even greater involvement because it gives you a platform. You don't have to, you know, write into the editor and see if they'll post it. You can start creating your own network. Now, that is incredibly participational. And if that's what people mean
right.
by democratic or democracy, we have the most incredible democracy in the ability to express themselves. So is that what Ben Franklin said? You know, the democracy has to have an educated citizenry. They have to be educated. They got to read the newspapers. They got to know what's going on. So is that what democracy is, just people being informed? Well, you've got that, you know, maximized by people being informed, being able to respond, to participate. So we have the most incredible utopian democracy been happening the last 10 years in terms of information exchange and involvement.
Right, or at least the potential for it.
Yeah. Well, no, there's just blatant participation going on.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Everybody's participating in all kinds of ways, by being a manager, by being a leader, by being a troll, every aspect. So maybe the goal of having democracy of expression ain't what we're looking for, because it's
right.
caused a problem. Well, it's caused dissatisfaction and people thinking they're losing their minds in this situation. They can't get a framework. And definitely McLuhan is offering a perspective, and James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake is so appropriate to our time that why not tell people, look, here's a book describing your experience on a Facebook forum or any form of noise. This is what this book shows you. This book predicted it. Now you can look at the phenomenon that Joyce presents and look at patterns in it using the book, which is all a big part of McLuhan's pedagogical approach was, hey, turn the kids on to Finnegan's Wake and show how it's relevant to their media experience right then in the 60s and 70s. So
right.
that what is the objection? Okay, McLuhan was also influenced by I.A. Richards, Bucky Fuller, and I start naming who else was he, who gives a fuck who he's influenced by? He came up with an original application of Finnegan's Wake. That's what we're supposed to learn from this. That's and it's a practical suggestion to all levels of citizenry and society. Use this book to figure out what's happened to you personally and locally and collectively. That's
right.
the simple fucking message. And
yeah.
and then these guys say, no, I worked in computers for 40 years ago. I know what it was like back then. Irrelevant responses. Or you include them as relevant responses, but they're just little angles, and they're not to be complained about. I mean, you
right.
got Anna Livia Pluribel posting pictures. Nothing wrong with that. That's their response. So then
yeah.
now, so Alan,
and I mean the
go ahead.
The other issue is that his response, Martin's response there to Blake, it doesn't seem to actually disagree. And I mean, you know, he says, I don't know what you mean with very poor media ecology, but he doesn't seem to try to get at what he means. He doesn't seem to...
Well, he says,
you know, he certainly doesn't look into the relative stability of authority phrase, and when he goes on to describe a mentality of exactly a nostalgia for the intellectual elite. I mean, like, what
wait,
do you think Blake
something.
Is
Hold
saying?
It. Hold it.
Yeah.
When he says his first sentence, there are thousands of people working on this topic, that means the topic's obsolete. That's McLuhan's very definition. When more and more people get involved with
right.
some scene, it is not relevant to what's really happening. It's not constitutive. So even that statement is poor, very poor media ecology to justify that you are against poor media ecology by stating a very unaware point that everybody's working on it. So what if the whole planet's working on it? That means something's
right.
being missed. Yeah, go back to what you were going to say. I just wanted to say that before we got lost.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just to say that they're working on it, I mean, that, again, it doesn't disagree with anything that he said, and it doesn't
right.
It doesn't prove anything. But, yeah, that, I mean, the whole point that he's talking about is lamenting the
loss of authority.
Elite. Yeah, he's saying, he says, I disagree that we don't need intellectual elites anymore. That's not what Blake Victor said. Blake Victor said there's a nostalgia on the part of the elite for the era when there was a relative stability of authority. And that's exactly what is being expressed by lamenting these barbarians at the gates forcing themselves onto the elite level. So it's just like, yes, there's definitely an issue of the, poor level of media ecology being expressed in the content. And then there's also this disconcerting disconnect between, like, you're not even disagreeing.
Yeah, yeah. They are actually want you to know where their, as Zappa would say, where their hurt is. Martin's saying, I'm a teacher. I have a bit of authority in my class. I know my McLuhan, and I teach it, and I impart this great knowledge. But I'm hurt that there's so many people don't appreciate me, and they're out there threatening to take over and fire me or something. You know, he takes it personally, which is the very nature and effect of electric media. People start taking reality personally. That's what
right.
McLuhan pointed out back in the 1560s. So you definitely do not mm-hmm. talk about your private point of view or defending your career or anything when you're doing media analysis. And McLuhan didn't even tell people he was a Catholic, for fuck's sake. No one even knew that
right.
in general. They know
right.
it now, but not back then.
Pride. Yeah.
You know, I heard just after McLuhan died, you know, last day of 1980, I wasn't in Toronto, so I didn't go to the funeral, but I was back in time to hear a bunch of intellectuals, Robert Fulford or a bunch of people, on some neocon guys, and maybe Derek DeKirko was on there, on CBC discussing the recent demise of McLuhan. And one guy said, I was totally shocked to hear that he was a Catholic. My God, I didn't know that. I mean, this really, I don't know what to make of this man, because he didn't act like a Catholic. And who knows what he thought, what he knew about McLuhan, but he didn't know that much. But that was an example right there of many people getting shocked that this hip avant-garde guy, seemingly avant-garde guy, who would show up every now and then and say Dali-esque or surrealistic statements, how could that guy be a Catholic? He's obviously an intellectual. He's a pagan bohemian or something.
He wasn't wearing his religion on his sleeve. And I guess similarly with his politics, he wasn't wearing his politics on his sleeve.
Right.
But it seems the attitude here is that you got to be wearing your politics on your sleeve in every post.
And what we're saying, what we're criticizing Martin and Alex of, I find that so prominent. It's not hard for me to say I am the only decent McLuhanite around. I've been on the media for 30 years, and no one knows anything about me. I just talk words about words and patterns. And so the rest of these guys are so irresponsible in the McLuhan land, McLuhan realm, that no wonder I got a superiority complex. You know, that's what I think personally, if you want to bring my personal thing in. But what do you think of that? I mean, you know that I've been that way all along. Are you still there?
Yes, sorry, I had to say something to someone.
Oh, okay. No, but you know what I'm saying. I've demonstrated that for decades. The McLuhan approach, and you remember people being puzzled by it. One should be puzzled at what McLuhan's doing. He says in one of those quotes I posted, I do not use the thought process when I communicate. What the heck does that mean?
That's definitely a puzzler.
Yeah. And you know what I say? He uses other people's words. He doesn't have to think about it. He hears your words, and then like William Burroughs wrote, McLuhan was a word analyst. He didn't care who or what you were. He would look at your words and then relate it to the new media environment. So he didn't have to think because he had a formula. You were, you know, hot, cool, this or that, visual or acoustic.
Yeah.
He applied a formula.
Well, yeah, you're looking for symptoms.
Yeah, you're like, he's a doctor looking for symptoms. And this thing about applying a formula, he writes way back in 1953 in his essay on Wyndham Lewis, which he did at the same time as James Joyce. He's talking about the formulaic method of Lewis, and he says that's the appropriate way you respond today. You have a formula, and scientists do it too, and you don't present your personal point of view. You figure out whether your formula can be relevant to people, and you try to make it relevant. So he is talking impersonally. He is acting. He is being the English language in response to post-English language media. That's the technique of the suspended judgment. And that Frank Zingroni seemed to be the only professor and longtime friend of McLuhan and student McLuhan who sort of intuited that. He had the guts to get in there, write an op-ed article in the Globe and Mail and talk about the obsolescence of university education. I never saw anybody do it as blatantly as he did. And he was a professor at York University. And so he approached McLuhan in pushing the envelope kind of patterns. And he also thought that he was not impressed with anybody who showed up after McLuhan transitioned, died, whatever happened to McLuhan. He called them posers, posers in baggy pants. And he actually was quite critical of everybody because they were not beginning from square one. Now, personally, I thought Zingroni still kept his opinion in there and wasn't as detached, but he was more detached than most. So there was one guy in academia who seemed to get it, what McLuhan represented. And it is pretty radical what McLuhan did. I guess it's in an individual's culture, you're supposed to be your point of view. That leads into voting and your individual rights and all that. And to put on people and say, I don't even agree with what you heard me type or heard me utter. That's not my point of view. That was a very strange phenomenon, and part of the reason why people got interested in it, because he was a strange, as his wife said, a strange bird, right? So I don't see Walter Ong and Jacques Ellul or anybody else being a strange bird. They were conventional POB guys writing books trying to explain things. And I thought that McLuhan remained relevant and why people are intrigued. They say, you know, I go back and read him. He still seems relevant. I don't understand it. This guy is a long time ago, kind of was wrong, but his thoughts are interesting because he said such amazing poetic statements like, what did he say? Spaceships would become edible? Remember that one?
I don't remember the exact quote, but yeah.
It's something like that, in Understanding Media. So he's a poet of – he turned public commentary, which was taking over in the democratic, hyper-democratic world since the 1670s of talk radio and everything else. He was being a poet within that situation and putting on the poetry of everybody having access to media and expressing their ignorance and defending it. So – that is the most interesting phenomenon of the 20th century than anybody's books or anything or what anybody artist did. And if
it's definitely a macro performance that way, even just within the books. There's that. I mean, that's the whole probing.
Yeah, but he didn't need the books. He could be fascinating wherever he showed up in any forum, in any kind of interview or interloping.
That's an interesting, just quickly aside, that's an interesting thing about, very telling thing about McLuhan in terms of compared to other philosophers that, you know, usually it's like they come out with a certain number of books, the books are this influential or whatever, and then they stop producing, they die or whatever, and then more things are published that are things that they wrote but didn't come out in their lifetime, but it's definitely marginal compared to the books, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas for McLuhan, his non-book output, not only does it absolutely dwarf the books, it's still, you know, it's like mapping the bottom of the ocean or something. It's still like most of it has not really seen the light of day. Like, most people have heard maybe 1% of the recorded audio material, let alone all of those, like, I want to read all of those articles that he wrote for a million different magazines. Like, those aren't all collected. Some of them are collected, you know. He's really turned this thing on his head where you know, and then from now and for the next few decades, it'll be eventually the McLuhan material, the bulk of it will be the non-books that came out after his death, you know.
So listen to this. In light of what you just said, I bought all the recordings from the Tony Schwartz collection at the Library of Congress, I think it is. I don't think it's the Smithsonian. It's the Library of Congress. And I posted them, and you hear, that's like 100 hours. It's a lot of material of McLuhan talking with Tony Schwartz and Wilbur Watson and other people in Tony Schwartz's studio and phone calls. It is the best biography of McLuhan because you hear how he reacts to people and what he is. And you think of it, I don't think there's no great artist in history, even up to Stravinsky or T.S. Eliot. I don't think there's that much recorded stuff about them other than maybe a few formal radio addresses or some lectures, but not endless improv, him making books. He's the most recorded.
And that, like, what,
let me say this. He's the most recorded intellectual up to now.
Yeah.
And they're available. I bought all the stuff and made them available. You know, I've noticed there's somebody taking my stuff. I think they're getting it from me. And they're making a beautifully designed layout. Have you seen those? They'll say, McLuhan talked.
Ooh, I very briefly looked at it when you posted it at some point, but I haven't been back.
No, not my thing. There's somebody
out there. I think you posted a link to it at some point.
Yeah, they have a beautiful the picture of the UT campus, and they give McLuhan addresses for them or something, or gives a talk at the UT, and it's all laid out, and it's a recording that comes from the Library of Congress. So I guess my stuff is there to be used. You can take it and grab it. So somebody's doing it very nicely. But so he's the most recorded guy. So like you say, who's writing books on that? Who's writing an essay on his conversation with Tony Schwartz and Wilford Watson, you know, in May 1968, where 100 talks were passed through I mean, he just goes from one thing to another, one pattern to another. That the mind in action is something we've never heard of anybody in history, in recorded history.
Yeah, I was thinking that that's the you really get the to really get the snake swimming in water, to know McLuhan like a snake swimming in water.
The dance of thought among words is the sensory modality, he says on page 136 of From Cliched Archetype. You want to look it up. The Thailander says that. I know it like a snake swimming in water. it's a sense of command and mastery. So, yes, McLuhan, you find it's an incredible artwork. It's autobiographical. So many things that he says cultures do, you can see him doing personally at different angles. You know what I mean? It's a very complex meta thing in his communication. And that would be the art part of it, the self-conscious reflection. But it's minor compared to what his sociological message was. You know what I mean?
Right.
Hey, you bring a new environment, it's going to wreck everything. So all these kids, all these parents have been giving their kids video games and early cell phones and whatever other digital devices they have. I don't have any children. I don't buy Christmas presents. I don't know what they give. But the point is, you do all the presents you gave your 20-year-old today, over the last 15 years, they led to Trump. And you're pissed off at fucking Trump, and he's a maniac. You caused it. This is what McLuhan says. You parents created it because you gave these toys to kids and didn't know that they'd alter society radically.
Right.
That's McLuhan's warning. And it's that simple.
Yeah, and it's about the that really speaks to the irrelevance of Alex talking about him being an early adopter of technology, because to the point of that doesn't mean that
he should say he should have
say anything about your it doesn't say anything about your literate sensibility, but
no,
it also,
he's a fan of literature, irrelevant. When you he should be McLuhan-esque enough to make fun. He says, I was a dupe of the early computer world. I got sucked into it. You know, instead of hoiking up the gadget lover, the Western archetype of the guy who's so proud of his technological knowledge and tinkering ability.
Yeah, he was on top of it before it was plugging into the internet, before it was publicly accessible, he says. But it's a funny thing, though. One thing that I was thinking when I was reading that is like, okay, you say that you're an early adopter because you had a computer, when was it? He got his first computer in 1983.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, well, I got my first computer later than 1983. It's probably more like 1987 or something. But I'm much more of an early adopter because I was 7. I was 6 when I got my first computer.
Yeah, 6 years old.
You know, so I know what I'm talking about, like, when it comes to this, the idea being that if you're gonna defend something, whatever he was trying to defend, you know, don't talk about you being an early adopter. Talk about are there any of the people who are 30-somethings today who have grown up with this stuff who are still doing like a literate academic type of thing or something.
Yeah.
Like, that would be more relevant.
Right. So I find that, you know, one guy wrote an article in Rolling Stone. McLuhan spoke at Berkeley in 1970, and a lot of stuff that, if you weren't up on McLuhan, was new. He laid out some new stuff. He would do that. He'd show up in the media about every year, every 18 months, and lay out his new stuff that no one even knew he was developing back at the Coach House. And so the guy writes this article reviewing it, and he's quite amazed by what McLuhan's saying. But at the end he says, you know, with McLuhan, you can't talk about what he says. You can't talk about it, which is actually true. How can you be verbal about a post-verbal medium? So, but the thing is, so you can't talk about it. So there's a truism in there. You can't be an academic about McLuhan. You can't study this stuff. You can go back and study the history of technology and that, but Baudrillard's point is there are no technologies right now. We're in a weird, abstract reality of unreality that's more real than reality and unreality, you know how he writes. And that's where we're at now. So to go back and analyze whether the printed book altered people or not, who's that for? It does not give people advice on how they live. Okay, so Elizabeth Einstein proves that the printing press did alter culture. Well, what happened since then? And what's happening now? And maybe the media doesn't affect people anymore. It did back then when it was simpler. So these things, you begin by saying we cannot talk about McLuhan. But maybe we should post what he said and then look at what he said and figure out what it could mean. What are the implications? Rather than whether it's true or not. Just look at the words. Because, you know, regular news is even more fake than all media were. McLuhan said that all media were pseudo events. So all media are fictions.
Right.
No big deal. Now, if you start talking about fake news, that's a squaring of the process. So the news people have to come up, or any TV station, has to come up with content. So there's 90% winging going on, lazily just dumping anything on. There's not even time to make quality programming. Just keep the can't have dead air. And so the news people do that. So therefore, everybody's a fallacy in terms of literate matching truth goals of 200 years ago. And that's why McLuhan said his fallacy. He admitted it was a fallacy. But it's actually how you talk about your interaction with information today, is that you are a fallacy from square one, because there's you're using an old medium first. Oh, yeah, what were you going to say? You started to say something.
Let's see. Yeah, because that definitely speaks to just, you know, this whole Postman question, and it just...
Amusing yourselves to death. That's, you know, you have to include all scenarios. We are Orwellian, we are Huxleyan, we're McLuhan, we're Joycean, we're LaRouchean. All these scenarios of so-called pretty important thinkers are what's happening today. You can't say it's more Huxley than Orwell. We are, you know, there's more not amusing ourselves to death going on today. Not amusing. You just call people's dropping out, becoming numb, motivated somnambulists who don't even want to know what's going on. Millions of those types, right?
Right. Not amusing, but, you know, faux informing ourselves is a problem.
Yeah, and what's wrong with amusing yourselves to death? I don't know what has died. There's many media environments that have come and gone. Which death are we worried about?
It does make some – I mean, this anxiety is still an appropriate thing. It's just really, you know, not only is it very poor media ecology, like as far as I'm concerned, it's disingenuous to try to bring Postman into this situation to talk about fake news in the new way of referring to a false news story that is making the rounds on Facebook among marginal something, when, you know, Postman is obviously talking about powerful news medium of, you know, a classic influence of the news as you know, and like the different ideas of a fake news, like just the idea that, okay, so you'd be, what, outraged that Trump or people would refer to CNN as fake news? Like, obviously this comes from, these people aren't convinced when you're like, well, there have been lies sometimes, or you couldn't rely on them for that story, because they're more thinking about, like, obviously it's mostly true, and a lot of it is undeniably true. How can you call it fake news when most of what they're saying is just undeniably true things, like, X person said Y. You know, that's not fake news, but the thing is, that is fake news. Because the whole idea is that there is a giant bias, and not one that is biased towards truth and everything that's best, and all those values. There's a giant bias behind deciding what is newsworthy.
Yeah.
Like, just because it's not false to say that X person made Y statement today in Z setting, it could be false to say, just to print it, just
to broadcast it.
The implied endorsement of it as an important thing to pay attention to, or a relevant thing to the current political topics, that could be incredibly fake, and it frequently is. Like, they won't even get into Postman on the terms of, however limited Postman might be from some other McLuhan standpoint, They aren't even anywhere close to dealing with Postman on Postman's terms, let alone updating it by 20, 25 years.
Exactly.
It's just like this idea of fake news is so one-dimensional, and how are McLuhan people, of all people, buying into a one-dimensional definition of fake news?
Right. So then you get, McLuhan said in the 70s, planet of the dead. He said, we're on the planet of the dead. Now, that's an interesting statement. I'm interested in why a person would say that. I'll look into maybe where he explains it. So we're not amusing ourselves to death. That's fucking optimistic, utopian, pie-in-the-sky shit. We already killed ourselves off, McLuhan said, by 1975. Now, I think thinking about that is McLuhan, is mediacology. It not saying, oh, that's stupid. That's McLuhan. He's depressed. He's a Catholic, or he's a lapsed Catholic, or he had a stroke 2 days ago. No, just take the words as they are and look at it and discuss it. As a matter of fact, as we're doing this is sort of pretty interesting how we're getting this. A lot more can be said than typing. And the McLuhan Forum should be on the forum here. We should be speaking our opinions on McLuhan or doing it. Why type? What's the point? It just leads to confusion and people misinterpreting and mistyping. You know what? I think we should announce that we've formed a new Facebook fucking page, but it's audio. And anybody can call into this thing and we'll discuss McLuhan and keep it to McLuhan. Bring up quotes. Stick to the thing and then point out, well, maybe this is not what's happening anymore. McLuhan doesn't apply. If it's a planet of the dead, then what came alive? Because many people think they're living. And McLuhan used to mock that. He used to say people think they're alive. Remember, he used to say, is there life before death? Was his big question. Is there life before death? Okay, so it seems to be a lot of activity. That's where you get into technology coming alive. That's the Android meme. That's the Matrix, or whatever terms you want to use. The meme part is important because mostly people are processing mental patterns or pattern recognition. They're not engaging in hardware. They're engaging in software and memes. That's what everybody's arguing about. So it's a robotic meme, not a robotic robot or something that sweeps up your kitchen. It's the meme level that we live in today.
Yeah.
Instant passing the world of pattern recognition, what McLuhan called the third Copernican revolution. I know in that context, if we were on an audio like you and I are, I'd automatically become the king of it because I can outquote McLuhan more than anybody. I got that kind of memory. That's my talent.
Right. Exactly. It's like even with the advantage of the whole, because obviously there's services created by being able to prepare your thought ahead of time and make sure you articulated it correctly and have the time to think of it and the detachment to not get all worked up or nervous or something. But those services are being swamped out by the disservices of the other forum disservices of petty bickering or something.
Yeah.
So it needs a shift.
And you actually, what's required in this situation? If we had 10 people discussing, you've got to be sensitive. You've got to be listening. You've got to notice, okay, I said my bit. Other guys wants to say something, I stop. And you let them speak. We do it on payday all the time. You have to notice, and this is good ear training, you have to notice that you could easily start talking over each other. And you want to avoid that as much as possible. Yeah. So you've got to stop and start real agilely. You know what I mean? So it's good training.
Yeah.
Now, I think that this is what I'm gonna put this out. Let's have a acoustic thing. Now, some people say, I'm no good on the phone. Well, fucking just listen then. You know what I mean? Don't feel that you
right,
have
or
to
prepare a couple of statements. Say like, okay, I've got a couple of things, like just, write a couple of little questions or statements, tentative statements to discuss.
I've thought so much of McLuhan that I think I'm one of the best at explaining, getting close to what he's saying. That's what I'd make myself available for. Okay, he said this in 1968. Well, look, here's the context. I did the archives for his wife. I know what was going on then and this and that. So he's responding to that, and is it consistent with what he wrote in the 50s or with Joycean or Wind and Moose? I can do all that. So I don't want to be a cult or a teacher, but I'm there to enhance people who are just coming in, and I'm probably the best.
Be a McLuhan interpreter.
Yeah.
Just bring me your McLuhan quotes, and I'll give you my best my best attempt of how to get there from here.
Right, and then I would also be interested in new interpretations. For example, the new director of the coach house, Miss Sharma, I think her name is Sharma.
Yep.
I looked up her academic record. So there she is. She's sort of well known for studying taxicabs. I don't. Mm-hmm. Did you look that up? Did you see that?
I saw that. I wished I could have read what she wrote, but it was behind some kind of paywall.
But the point is that whatever you wrote, Ms. Sharma, about cabs, apply it to Trumpism. Apply it to today. That's what we require if you're in the McLuhan forum, in the McLuhan mode. Taxi cabs, rather obscure, might be interesting, but
it's pretty crucial. It's a hot spot of being taken over by a new technology now.
Yeah, the Uber.
It's a classically immigrant profession, and oftentimes immigrants with a lot of specialized training that they're not able to use.
Right. Now, we should maybe end soon, but for titillating gossip, we must include gossip. McLuhan said the Global Village was a gossipocracy. Gossipocracy.
Right. Yep.
Here's a little gossip. Ms. Sharma, when she spoke in Berlin at the Canadian Embassy, their McLuhan Salon, I had a friend there who got there early and taped the recording, which was posted on the McLuhan Facebook, but then met Ms. Sharma in the cloakroom after. And Ms. Sharma was very upset about the McLuhan world. And she seemed to have been crying before she spoke. This is what my colleague noticed. So there was a whole problem that she was having in her role there at the embassy line. So I checked out my sources and found out what was really going on, and I'm not going to say what it is, but I've got gossip, like I always do, if you're interested in that. But I don't know if I'd do it on a recording level. I'd make a few predictions about what's going on. But on the surface, she did say, when my friend approached her and they got talking, she said, "Are you a media ecologist?" Like, suspicious. "Are you a media ecologist? Like, I find that they're not too attractive. They're a problem," said Ms. Sharma. She's the head of something.
Wary.
It doesn't fit with her academic background or what she's about, so we can watch what's going to happen. But that kind of gossip level of human behavior, I've had access to for 50 years in the McLuhan world. I've got so much gossip, the stuff that people really like on a certain level, about everybody and anything. It's a whole, unpublishable archive. So we even got that if you want to hear about it when we do our thing. And I'm not doing it to get attention. Many people, they say, okay, McLuhan said Planet of the Dead. Was he depressed then? Had his wife left him? What the hell was going on with him to say such an absurd thing? Well, I can tell him. Well, I'll say, well, this happened or that happened. You give some personal details, because when you have somebody say something, always that's part of the ground is, who are they? What's their background? What are their hurts? What are their desires? What have they been doing?
What's been happening to them recently?
Yeah, and that's what people want. That's why they go meet McLuhan. They want to check him out on the personal level back then. That's what people would do. Everybody wants to see what they can see from their own intuition to decide whether it's worth continuing to study. So I acknowledge that part of human curiosity, but I'll stick to the statements themselves regardless of who said them or whether he was a Catholic or whether he read Vannevar Bush or not. It doesn't matter whether he read Vannevar Bush. And that's another topic on this stuff we have. They're wondering whether Vannevar Bush said something before McLuhan did. Well, Vannevar Bush did not relate it to what was happening in baseball or happening in painting. He did not go across the culture and look at the effect of whatever his essay was about, the computer model he laid out, and discuss the potential effects of it. Nobody did that. That's what
it hardly matters if he said something that McLuhan said first and better. I mean, there are other There are other people who made maybe more specific, if in a fragmented way. There are some people who made more accurate predictions of the internet than McLuhan's predictions of the internet. Like, his are a little bit impressionistic in some ways, but he predicted it much more, in the sense of he knew for sure what was coming, and it wasn't just some fragmentary, I know I have a vision of the next stage of this technology. He predicted the world of it and the experience of it.
And yeah, and the effects on other media. There's
right.
a great quote he did in the second phase of Exploration Magazine, the insert in Varsity Graduate, alumni magazine in the mid-60s, and in 1968 he makes this incredible statement about the hologram, which I have in my essay, McLuhan goes something like, the hologram will wipe the deck of the audience's
right.
intellect.
I've been trying to get that one definite. I might be able to verbatim it. After saying other things, using different media as their content, and he says the laser beam will use the intellect of the audience right off the court deck, and they will be scrubbed but good.
Very good. That is the quote. It's one of his best quotes. Say it
yeah.
again. Say it again.
I might be missing something. There's something about human
dreams.
No,
you got it. You got it.
So the laser beam will use, it was like so-and-so uses
the audience
film,
intellect.
Film used the novel as its content. Something used that as its content. The laser beam will use the intellect of the audience right off the court decks, and it will be scrubbed but good.
And I think it's an oddly stated, I think it's audience intellect. Not audience.
Yeah.
I mean, I could look it up. I have it in my essay. But anyway, that's close enough. Okay, what an incredible statement. Vannevar Bush never said that. He never said, he just was hoping he could make something that would help humanity, adding a new technology, right? And McLuhan,
right, I know. That sounds more like some sinister, protocols of the Elders of Zion type of talk. You know, if you're going to find someone who said anything like that, you'd look for some, secret plans rant of we're going to, sci-fi bulldoze all of humanity.
So as we get this is what's fun about talking McLuhan. It's no fun talking Elizabeth Einstein or Ong. There are interesting statements by Ong about maybe the effect of the manuscript on religion and different things, but they are they require what? Reading, checking other scholarship. You don't have to check with McLuhan. You just think about, well, okay, I've seen this science fiction movie. They tried to show something like that. You have a lot. Look at this. McLuhan was a poet of evoking what was in people's minds because they've been swallowing so much information for 30 years in the mid-20th century. They didn't know that the language was not verbal. It was multi-imagery. And so he played off the imagery that was in the world's mind. And did a poetry in response to it. Now, what I just said is I don't think it's ever been said before. But McLuhan leads to interesting self-statements that are fun and creative. And so we just showed that you get more out of what we just did in the past hour and a half in relation to McLuhan than anything that's ever posted anywhere ever, because you're up to date and I'm up to date. So we're not victims.
And we care about McLuhan. We care. We're aiming to try to understand McLuhan rather than just curate some ongoing stream of references to him.
Right. And I'm not trying to get I'm not trying to get a raise in my pay from doing this. I'm not trying to get a new house. I'm not trying to get a promotion. And I'm not trying to make enemies.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
You've been accused of that.
Yeah. So actually, but the poet, what is it, reunites, what did Eliot say? He updates the dialect of the tribe. Well, we've got many things to talk about today because people have multiple bodies. And I'm interested in the Esperanto of that. What could be shared? What could a common eureka of, we can all say, yeah, that's pretty valid. I can use that one. You can use it. The other five people listening can use that insight. And they can tell it to their neighbors or to their family. That's it's a kind of healing that I see McLuhan initiating. a mental healing.
Well, it's the talking cure, because it's about the mild mental illnesses, or mild, maybe they're not so mild, but the mental illnesses that come from the media.
Right. So we'll somehow announce to the forum that we're opening a new thing, and we're going to do better than whatever was done so far. Just all you have to do is call in. And and we'll make it an American number, so maybe Canadians have a problem if their phone can't make it, it's too expensive, blah, blah. Well, maybe we'll adjust to that. You can come in on Skype. But the point is, speech is faster than typing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Speech is faster, and if you stop and start and don't drown out people and try to make a point of your knowledge, don't shine your knowledge into someone else's face, then you end up like the Monday Night Seminar with McLuhan.
Right.
That's what it was like. It was pretty good.
It would help to have a stenographer taking notes and being able to replay the best parts, but then again, if it's a recording you can listen to.
And we don't care whether it's heard again. Just show up for the next one when it's scheduled. So I think we've made a good beginning here.
It's just these things about illiterate sensibility, you know. I mean, it's like just the idea of taking it only on this strict level of elites in the culture and
how much one knows McLuhan, you know.
What is the overt status of what's the overt status of intellectual elites in the culture? It's just no. It comes down to a much more fine-grained thing about just your ability to separate functions in your life, or someone's ability to carry on a conversation like this, whether or not they like received terrible news earlier in the day or something. You know, like just people didn't used to be able to compartmentalize.
Yeah. So let's see. That would be a good backing for my idea of the multiple bodies we have. You could have had a personal disaster in your chemical body life earlier today, and yet you can go into this other space, which I'm calling the chip body, and be distracted from your chemical body problems for a while and actually make apparent pattern recognitions and not amuse yourself to death. You know, that's what's available here. Let's see. That was good. I'm never going to stop using McLuhan and post-McLuhan and whatever else. Or I quote Brian Taylor. Have you studied Taylor? You read his post, you know, over there at the Nigel Craig site? No, you haven't been. You're not up on him, eh? It's really interesting how McLuhan retrieve the, you could call it the humanist agenda, the basic decency of some kind of sharing in a new situation that no one had ever had the opportunity to do. So no wonder that Catholic Church is belatedly thinking, maybe this guy was a saint, you know, maybe we should do something with him, you know.
That cathode ray mission from Videodrome was a good idea.
What was that?
It was like a homeless shelter place, like a drop-in for homeless people. But instead of, you know, maybe they did offer food or something, but instead of being a place to come and have a meal, it was a place to come and have a few hours of TV. That's what these people really need, is to feel like they are part of the culture, and that's going to do better for them than, you know, some job training or a meal even or something.
Right. And it sometimes does better than reading McLuhan.
Yeah, it could be. There's some revelatory stuff on TV sometimes.
All right. So let's end this one, and we'll see what we can do, spread awareness, and see if anybody wants to hear this. But this is our this is the way one discusses McLuhan. Even if you were typing it, technique is suspended judgment. Let anybody say anything and take it. You can quote Vannevar Bush, but why would you? There are no standards in this situation. You can't say someone's more academic and less academic. You can't say one's a leader or one's a cult victim. Can't say that about anybody. You can't bring chemical body values into this chip body situation. So that's what this is about.
Okay. Yeah, the relative stability of authority.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian, and let me stop the recording.
It was fun.
Yeah, stay on the line, but I'll just stop the recording.